Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Sanjay Touré in another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. Sanjay, how's your Memorial Day weekend been going for you?
It's been going very well, actually.
How are you enjoying this 90 degrees every day?
I've been by the pool
a lot.
Yeah.
You look a little tanner.
Darker, do I?
You do.
Yeah. I was by the pool all weekend. Yeah.
Are you enjoying that?
I am.
And then not as much you're going to enjoy this show. You know, we got a little sauna action going here because the air conditioning doesn't work on holiday weekends.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
I noticed. I'm kind of sweating right now.
Exactly. But this is going to be fun. We got old friend, new friend, and we're going to kick it off with Pete Canalicchio. He is with Brand Alive. Welcome, Pete.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Well, Pete, since the last time we chatted, your career has gone through several iterations, I believe.
It's evolving. It's continually evolving. That's correct.
So tell us about how you keep your career alive with Brand Alive now.
Well, this has been an exciting journey, and it really has come to fruition over the last 5 years or so as I was developing my thinking and methodology as it related to expanding brands and then getting more involved in marketing those brands and then still having the licensing business. And so over the last 2 or 3 years, I felt it was really important to bring that all under the umbrella of Brand Alive and my own website, PeteCanalicchio.com. So that the book and my writing and my workshops and my consulting could all be aligned with a purpose.
So now brand is at the heart of everything you do, right? Because you can't license anything that doesn't have a compelling story and a compelling brand around it. So that has to be a subset, right?
Absolutely. The whole premise of the book I wrote last year that published in February called Expand, Grow, Thrive was understanding and identifying how brands should expand and how they reach their optimal expansion. So it is a critical component, licensing, of a brand's life.
So now, how are you defining Brand Alive? What are the kind of tenets or components of that?
So what we're saying is for everyone who has a brand, they want to aspire that that brand comes alive in the hearts of their constituents, the fans, the consumers. And so with that as a goal, what we're trying to do is surround them with the resources that they need to understand their brand's positioning, architecture, promise, story, and then how that brand would expand into new categories or extend into new categories. And then ultimately, how do you market that story? How do you tell that story to the target audience so that the folks that are wanting the brand become aware of it and then they get to enjoy it once they've tried it?
Now, does the same kind of philosophy work for B2C companies as B2B, or is this kind of more a B2C kind of methodology?
That's a great question. I want to say that it tends to be a little bit more B2C, but the truth is we all buy from emotion. So if you're a business buying resources from another business, you're going to be emotionally connected to that business that's your supplier. So even though we talk about B2C having more of that Brand Alive connection, it really does have its role in B2B as well.
Well, walk me through kind of how you would attack a new client or a new engagement. Let's start with and I'd like to play out a B2C and a B2B example. So you're a B2C company. Let's take Icha. Icha Quintero is going to be in the show. She's got handmade jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
She sells primarily, I would imagine. We don't know this. We'll learn more. But she sells to consumers.
Mm-hmm.
How would you kind of begin the basic building blocks of creating a brand that's memorable and compelling and tells a story?
So for Icha, this is, you know, critically important that she understand the why before she understands the what. You know, why does she do what she does, and what does she do, and how does she do it? So getting at that is really getting at Icha's story and knowing that story and making sure that the story is genuine and real and can connect with consumers is a critical part of ultimately the purchase for those consumers, because the jewelry itself might be beautiful, but if they can connect to the person who created the company, formed the company.
The why behind why she creates jewelry is kind of as important, if not more important, than the actual jewelry themselves. Because they're buying a piece of her, right? They're buying a piece of her brand and her kind of story.
100%. So we want to connect with somebody. And then we can ultimately, if we fall in love with the jewelry, right, we will become advocates, and we'll not just talk about the jewelry. We'll talk about Icha and how she became,
right,
how she came to start her company. And so that is such an important component. And that's what we would start with, is that story.
And then just start, and you would invest a lot of time and energy in kind of crafting that story and massaging it and keeping it true and authentic and real. That's important. But just working on kind of how you tell the story, right?
100% is correct. So getting the story defined and then understanding the position of the product in the brand. So who is the audience that we're trying to reach, and making sure we know how to reach them. And then creating an architecture. So, you know, what are the physical attributes? What are the functional benefits? What are the emotional benefits? And then ultimately, what is Icha's promise? What is she promising? I say a brand is a promise. So if you think about yourself as a brand, or if you think of a company as a brand, that brand is making a promise to the consumer. And so that's the critical piece.
Mm-hmm. And then so you would, and that comes before, even if she was starting from scratch and didn't have jewelry, this would be probably the building blocks for the company or any type of a company like this, right? You have to get that part right, because if you get that part wrong, you're on a wrong path.
100% correct again. And the whole point of this is that, you know, for a lot of companies, the founder is critical to the company's success. Elon Musk is an example. You know, he's founded, you know, several companies, Tesla, you know, SpaceX, and the folks that gravitate to those companies, they're gravitating to those companies, especially because of Elon Musk.
Right. They're betting on him.
Correct. And they're believing his story. He's all around this idea of sustainability. So if you believe in sustainability, regardless of, you know, where you're born, where you're raised, what your political leanings are, then you're going to get behind him and you're going to want to support him.
So now when you're doing your work for these larger enterprise companies that have usually brands, and how do you kind of help them when there's already kind of a card has been played and you got to kind of work around the parameters of that?
So we typically challenge to see whether there is a story and then whether the story is still relevant. And so we'll look at the literature that's out there. Are they communicating the story properly? And most cases, the story has evolved, so they need to refresh it. And once we're able to do that for them, then we're doing effectively an audit. We're checking their architecture. We're reconfirming that their promise is the same.
And then it's consistent across platforms, right? Because sometimes that gets confusing, too, with all these different media platforms.
That is one of the key problems that established brands face. They grow, they evolve. Folks who are not necessarily really skilled in branding and brand strategy take the brand and they evolve it on their own. They don't check with the folks that are responsible for that. And so the brand starts to be communicated in a whole host of different ways. And one of the key things that we say in branding is that everything communicates. So if you're communicating something that you're not even aware that you're communicating, you're telling your consumers something about the brand that may not be aligned with its architecture and its promise. So it's critical to get that back on track.
Yeah, even if you're branding whether you think you are or not, right?
Exactly. So
you might as well get some control over this.
And I saw that when I was at Newell Rubbermaid. I was working with the Rubbermaid brand, and there was a whole host of sub brands that were created, and the Rubbermaid brand was in a red color, but the sub brands were in all different colors. And then the sub brands in many cases were portrayed as larger than the brand itself on packaging and on marketing collateral. And the brand was getting lost in this dog's breakfast, for lack of a better term. And so we had to revisit the whole branding strategy. What was our promise? What were we trying to convey? And then create a whole new visual identity. And once that had occurred, this sea of different colors and messages came back to this beautiful, strong, powerful red color and one solitary message. And it was really remarkable to see that.
And that's kind of at the heart of what you do, right? Where it's time periodically, your brand needs kind of a a refreshing or a relooking at what is, because it just kind of slowly creeps, right? This is one of those things where if you're not mindful about this stuff, just a new, you hire new people, people have different things, and there's all these channels, somebody's in charge of social media, somebody, all of a sudden they're all going their own way slowly over time, and it's just slow and incremental, and you don't even notice it. And then until you kind of take a fresh look at things, you're like, hey, look, I'll put this all on the wall. This is all what we're saying. Is this what we believe? And then the people who are in charge don't even, they can't even articulate what they believe anymore.
It is so the case. It's so challenging and difficult, even for the world's greatest brands, to keep that in check. I mean, maybe a company like Procter & Gamble does it as well as anyone can, and they probably still have their challenges. The second part is the environment changes, the marketplace changes, and consumers' tastes change. And so brands do have to evolve. They should be true to the promise, but they have to evolve to be, I would say, evergreen, but ever relevant as well. And so that's important, even if you're on your game as far as the visual identity is concerned.
Right, because and things move so quickly. And that's a challenge to larger institutions, right, where they're not as nimble maybe as kind of these up-and-coming brands that can adjust quickly and then all of a sudden have a presence. And then the incumbent is like, where did these people come from?
It is so true, and you can see brands that have come and then they've gone, and sometimes they resurface because somebody sees that latent value and they capture it and they license the brand and they revisit it. Polaroid's an example where it was very powerful, very big, and then it was gone, and then some folks recognized that value and they brought it back, and it's done remarkably well. But the ones that are on their game and really understand branding will continue to revisit the brand and never, never not do their research to understand where the consumer's at and what they're communicating and making sure that story is still relevant and that promise is still relevant.
And they have to be willing to kind of blow things up a little bit too, right? And that's never easy for larger institutions.
It is so difficult. If we look at General Motors, for example, what happened there, 10 years ago, they were almost out of business, and then they had the chance to relive, to kind of live again. And so they got rid of a number of their brands, and then they kept certain ones that they felt were important. And if you look at the Buick brand, for example, they've gone through a whole repositioning, right? And that whole advertising campaign is, I'm in the Buick, and they're like, I can't find your car. It's like, well, it's right here. Now it's even more like, no, not that Buick, the one over there.
Right.
And so how many dollars have gone into that? But I believe at the end of the day, Buick as a brand will live because the company has been smart enough to recognize we have to reposition the brand to be relevant to today's consumer, because the ones that are buying it, they're dying. And so we have to be relevant to a younger audience.
And then, but for leadership to have the foresight to kind of look that far ahead and bet on the future, and then I don't want to say abandon the past, but it definitely kind of look more towards forward rather than backwards. That's hard for a lot of large companies to do. I mean, you look at a Netflix, and Netflix saying, hey, look, we disrupted Blockbuster. Look, everybody's buying, getting these things in the mail. And then all of a sudden they're like, yeah, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to go to streaming, when they were still successful at the top of their game and nobody else was competing with them by doing it through the mail. I mean, that's bold.
It is amazing. I look at the Netflix brand and how successful it is. And then I think about the name. That name at the time had no relevance. Today it has an infinite relevance. And so I give kudos to the founders who are saying, we're going to create a name that actually will paint the future, when today it doesn't mean anything. And so amazing what they did. I always go back to Coca-Cola. I'm a former Coca-Cola employee. Coca-Cola, lives globally, but its home is in Atlanta. That's a brand who stays connected to their story, which their story is dates back to 1886, and that is relevant. But then they evolve, and they still make it fresh and new every day, but they never lose their past, and that connection is what's critical to any enduring brand success.
And then in their case, to have so many brands individually that are, billion-dollar brands kind of under the radar, people think of Coca-Cola, and they don't understand that there's dozens of billion-dollar brands underneath them.
That's right. And so they might look at their flagship brand as the key critical one, but Sprite and Fanta and Minute Maid and all those other brands, you know, Powerade, Smartwater, Dasani. Those are all important, and they all have their own brand positioning, their own story, and their own target audience, and they have to be relevant and stay relevant with that audience.
Right, and flex to the new tastes of individuals nowadays. I mean, it's not easy.
It's not. And
that's why they need experts like you to come in there and just have a conversation, right?
I love that. I love going in. I just came off of a project with a client that has been around a long time, who has an established brand but was losing some relevance and was thinking about how to expand that brand. And so we got to dig in and really understand what the brand stood for, and then say, okay, if that brand stands for this particular emotional connection, where can it have the ability to go? What's permission does it have to move into new categories? How would those new categories reinforce that promise? Mm-hmm. And it was just a fun, exciting exercise that will ultimately result in new growth for this company in meaningful ways, where consumers are going to go, my gosh, I'm so excited to see this brand in this category. I didn't know they were going to go there, but now that they're there, it makes perfect sense,
right? And that's really the key. It has to kind of dovetail elegantly and make sense in the eyes of the consumer, whether they knew it or not.
Right. And, you know, Apple did that. Steve Jobs did that masterfully. But what happens a lot in the coaching I give is sometimes companies have the ability to go into a new category. I say that in the sense that there's a licensee who's willing to pay them to go into a new category, and no one's done the hard work to say, is that category actually reinforcing our brand positioning and our promise?
Right.
And when it's not,
then that's where it dilutes the message in the story, right?
Exactly.
So you got to be, you know, you got to choose wisely your partners.
You have to choose, and you have to do your homework ahead of time. You have to know what you stand for, and that's the part I really enjoy.
Right. I was reading about CrossFit, the CrossFit brand. They're very selective. They don't just slap their name on anything, and then they fight for their trademark, you know, very aggressively to make sure that it's not misused in the marketplace.
That's one of the brands that I talk about in Expand, Grow, Thrive, and I love their story because they, the owner of CrossFit, has empowered all of these trainers around the globe, and it's cultish in its zeal, everyone's zeal for the brand, and they're highly protective of the brand, as you say. And the franchisees or the licensees, they feel strongly about the CrossFit brand as the owner does.
Right, and that's where the rubber hits the road, right?
Yeah, and then resultingly, the folks that are CrossFit fitness enthusiasts, they are just as impassioned as everyone.
And that's what every brand's shooting for, to me. I mean, that's what that outcome is, what your goal is. You want your, you know, at every level, everybody to be protective and proud and excited to be part of it.
There's a whole aspect of authenticity there, and you know, those that want to participate and those that aren't able to. And in the CrossFit community, it's kind of one of those, like, we're part of a tribe and we look at ourselves as a one unit, and then those on the outskirts, they probably never could do it anyway. So it's kind of one of those where it's like, we're happy that we're not everybody's fitness brand. We're the brand for those that really care about the ultimate in fitness.
And that's the authenticity, and that's what brands should stand for. They can't, if everybody is appropriate for it, then nobody's appropriate for it.
Exactly.
You got it. Those are part of the lines you have to draw, right? This is for you. It's not for you.
You were talking about this right before we started with Atlanta Business Radio, right? We want to be everywhere for the people that matter to us, and we matter to them. And the rest of the world's audience, that's not important, because we're making a promise to a specific target audience.
Right. So now, if somebody wanted to learn more, have more substantive conversation with you?
So the best way is go to petecanalicchio.com, and that's PETECANALICHIO.com. And everything is rolled up under there. So that is my ethos. That's my story. That's my service offering.
You can get the books. You can get the workshops and all the good stuff, right?
Right, which is exciting. And I'll share one more piece. So we launched the book last year in February of 2018. The website launched this year in March of 2019. And behind that came 10 additional e-books or e-guidebooks that are self-help tools for those who want to expand their brand. And it starts from the very top, which is all around the ideas. You know, should you be even considering brand expansion and brand licensing as a growth strategy, to if you are considering it, is your brand able to stretch into new categories, all the way down to how do I negotiate a deal so that I can make sure that it's going to be favorable to me and be enduring, and then tools and templates for those who are in the thick of it and just need to make sure that they have a good, solid framework from which to start.
Because any companies of all sizes, branding's important too. And you have offerings for companies of all sizes, right? Whether they're the largest companies on the planet or the small guy just getting started, there's stuff there for everybody, right?
This is the thing that I was thinking about when I wrote these. There's a couple of folks that I had in mind. There is that person who joined the licensing department of an established company who is very smart. She knows her brand. She knows her marketing. She really doesn't know brand licensing. And this is a chance for her to hone her skills in that area and elevate herself so that she's just as sharp in that area. Then there's the person who is thinking about this as a potential for growing their company, whether they're the owner of the brand or their company who has a great product or service who would like to acquire a license. How do we give them all the knowledge so that they can actually get into this industry successfully? And then there's the person who's managing a department, and she's saying, listen, I've got some, you know, rock stars who are just killing it, and I've got a whole group of others that are smart, but wouldn't it be great if I could get the level of knowledge all the same so we could right. all work from the same level? And so that's where the tools and the workshops and everything really lend themselves to helping each of these different groups.
Good stuff. Well, Pete, thank you so much for sharing your story.
It's a pleasure being here. Thanks so much, Lee.
All right. Hang with us. A couple more guests. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have Icha Cantero. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Icha, did you learn anything there?
Yes, I did. And thank you for all the interesting information.
It's a pleasure.
So tell us about your brand. How are you serving folks?
Well, I make handmade jewelry, and I make jewelry from a medium called polymer clay. And polymer clay is a moldable clay that you can create many different forms from it, and then you bake it and it hardens. So I came into my small business just as anyone else, beginning with the learning process, and now I'm trying to be able to also teach the things that I do.
So now you started with clay. Was there some reason for that? Is there something in your childhood, or what drew you to this clay?
Something in my childhood did bring me to the jewelry. I come from a family of jewelers, so I've been in the jewelry business for a long time.
What's your first memories of jewelry with your family?
Well, coming into the shop and...
So they had just, a shop?
Yes, they do. In my country, I'm from Honduras.
So in Honduras, was it your parents or grandparents?
My grandparents and all their kids.
So they had a shop selling jewelry?
Yes, high-end jewelry. And I would work in the production area. And I would just love my work. I would come after school. I was 14 when I started. And I would walk from school to the jewelry shop and start working. And
but
I would.
What did you like about it?
I liked the process of creating things from nothing to something.
And then, what about the joy of seeing the person buy it and be?
That's one of the greatest joys that you can, as an artist, that you can have, is someone else carrying your piece.
So you have the vision in your head of what a piece should be, and then you spend the time and effort creating it, and then someone else loves it and
yes.
then can't wait to wear it. That must be so rewarding.
It is. And one of the things that I've heard people tell me a lot is that that they have never seen this kind of medium used in this kind of way that I'm using it. So people are drawn to my creations because of the colors and the designs.
So now, so what made you want to use this material in this way?
Well, I started looking for something that was that I could create many different kinds of designs with it, and I tried many things, and
what's something that you tried that didn't work?
Different kinds of clays, because
clays.
Yes, different kinds of clays, because polymer clay can be baked in low temperatures. Mm-hmm. So pottery clay, which was the first thing that I thought of.
You needed a higher temperature?
Yes. So polymer clay you can bake at home. And the other kinds of clays you need an industrial
oven. Right.
Yeah.
Now, so you make that kind of mental shift, you're now doing something different.
Completely different, yeah. And it has many steps to it. It was very hard to learn at the beginning because there's very little information.
So you were just figuring this out on
your
own?
Yeah, I was
Trial and error.
And there are many brands of clay and just... visiting the different brands and different thicknesses that you could...
So how'd you know you were onto something? What was the first hint that you were like, oh, this might work?
Well, I really wanted it to work, first of all. But then I started posting my first creations online and social media. And people... I had very positive response to this. And little by little, I started to evolve into see that the quality would be a better quality and that my pieces would be have the designs that people were looking for and a piece of, it may sound cliche, but a piece of my heart in each piece that people could feel that I was making this out of love, that I enjoyed making every piece. And for me, that's basically my experience. I really enjoy making them.
Now, I don't understand the jewelry business at all, but I know that jewelry can have lots of different pricing. How do you come up with and price is a story, and that's an element of the brand too. How do you kind of come up with a price that you feel is representative of your effort and your art?
So my price range is very broad because I want people to be able to afford it, but I want also to have pieces that that have gems and things that are a little bit more on the high end. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for that piece... The prices range from 35 to 70, more or less, some a little bit higher, some a little bit lower. But it depends on how much time it took me to create it and the difficulty of the piece, most of all. But I do incorporate other components to my jewelry. Normally, I try to incorporate components also handmade by other artists so that the piece is completely handmade.
So you create kind of mashups between multiple artists into one piece?
Yeah, that's what I try to have. For example, I make some pieces that are made from with the polymer clay and with hand-blown glass. But I try to look for hand-blown glass that is handmade by someone by another artist or the patina metal components. I buy them directly from another artist. So that way, the person that's buying it has a complete handmade piece that has not only my story and not only my heart, but every piece of that piece is made by
hand.
Yeah.
So now, what does your family think of this endeavor?
Well, my kids love it because polymer clay is similar to Play-Doh. When it's raw, when it's not baked, and so you can create so many things. And I've gotten my kids to create their own things as well. So they really, really love it. And my husband, since we are in a team, we are in it together. We came to the States a year and a half ago, and we are both working hard. So once I started this business. there were many things that happened. One, I could start to be able to bring something back home, a little bit of extra money. And the other thing is that it made me happy. Mm-hmm. A change of country can sometimes be a little bit hard on you. And when I found this medium and I started to work with this, it really got me in a good position in my mind, in my heart, and in my state.
I'm going to ask Sanjay to jump in here because she is a super fan of jewelry and creativity. So I thought she might have some. She's from Liberia, so she came from another country too. I thought your insights would be important here.
So I'm just going to ask directly about the jewelry itself. What's the process of making it from the very beginning?
So first, the polymer clay comes in blocks, in small blocks, and you have to massage them to soften them. And we use a pasta machine to condition the clay, and that's used. All the polymer clay artists use it. It's very commonly used. So you run it through the pasta machine several times until it's soft enough, but it also helps you stretch it. Once it's stretched and you have it in the thickness that you desire, then you have to cut it, and there are several different techniques that you use for cutting them, and then you hand mold them. And that will create, for example, in my case, my designs are very floral. So I create petals and I create leaves and things like that. So I hand mold them and then I bake them. And once I bake them, then I can continue to the process of starting to design each piece. And if I've created several of different leaves and petals, then I can start seeing the floral designs, how they come together. Then I have to drill them and glue them together and use the different components I was talking about earlier to create the end piece, which will be a unique, one-of-a-kind piece.
So looking at your website, I see a lot of earrings. Do you make any statement necklaces or rings? Yeah,
I do. I've just started making necklaces a few weeks ago, and I have sold out because I have returned customers and they've been waiting for me to create necklaces. So necklaces have been a huge success, and I will be creating more. They take a little bit of time to create. Each piece takes a little bit of time to create. So I post new things on my website every 2 to 3 weeks because it takes time to create every piece.
So what's your favorite part about making jewelry?
The creative process. I really enjoy when I have all my different petals and start to combine all of these. But also when I sell it to a customer, because the faces that they make of finding this piece that talks to them is very, very rewarding.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, now what do you have ahead?
Well,
you have a website right now, or how do you sell your stuff? Mainly, do you use Etsy?
Sell through Etsy, and I go to art fairs.
You go to festivals and
shows. And so, if you want to see where I'm going to be the next weekend, then I post it on my Instagram or on my Facebook account, which is Icha Cantero, handmade jewelry, or just. If you type Icha Cantero, IchaCantero, then you will find me. And I like to be able to create new things in the future. Right now I started with the necklaces, and then I'm going to continue to other kinds of accessories. But I'm also trying to take this to a level where I can also teach this kind of art. Mm-hmm. I'm a part of the Georgia Polymer Clay Guild, or Greater Atlanta Polymer Clay Guild, and I have taught some lessons there about how to make the petals. Some of the techniques that I use, I've come up with them. People that have been in the business for 20 years had never seen things that I have created, and that's because I use polymer clay a little bit differently than other people do. It's like a little bit of innovation there. Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. Well, congratulations on all your success.
Thank you very much.
And then again, they can go to Etsy and then look for your name.
Yes, Icha Cantero, Handmade Jewelry.
And then on Facebook, the same thing.
Yes.
And then...
And Instagram.
And then you're at festivals around town or around the region? Is that where you typically go?
Yes, I do festivals in Georgia. Mm-hmm. As far as Blue Ridge, and I've gone to several in the city.
Right, and then a little on the outskirts.
Yes.
Well, congratulations, Icha. Thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, hang with us. We got one more guest. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we got Rita Trehan with Dare Worldwide. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You're gonna have to get in there and rockstar this microphone.
Okay. Hi.
All right, Rita, tell us about Dare Worldwide. How are you serving folks?
Well, we look at companies that are going through some kind of transformation or change, or who are looking to try and take their business to the next level, whether it's a small startup company or a large Fortune 500 company. We really work with them to partner, I guess, on some of the things that we've already heard this morning around sort of brand. Like, how do you actually make that live through the people? We don't do work in brand, but what we do is we try and help them think about what's the capability of their organization to really deliver on that kind of brand promise. And we try to help them think about how you develop leadership capability that you need to survive in today's business world.
So now, how'd you get into this line of work?
Yeah, so I started my career in human resources. Didn't think that was a career that I was ever going to get into when I started it. And like most people who start a career in human resources, they never go in thinking that that's the career that they want to do. I always had a passion for business. Like my fellow guest here today, I started in my family business many, many years ago.
What was that?
They were in clothing I started at the age of 6. They put me out to work at a very early age. They figured that a cute little kid sitting outside the shop might attract some clients. But
so
I
were in sales and marketing at 6.
I had to work out my own commission, which wasn't always easy. But I had a love for business, and I think I just fell into HR because it gave me the opportunity to really understand business end to end. And I still do a lot of work in HR, partly because I'm on a mission, if you like. I have a massive passion for human resources being what they should be, not what people think they are.
So what should they be? How do you define human resources?
They should be the CEOs of the business of HR, not just functional silo experts, because that's the role that they should play today in today's business.
So you think they've kind of devolved into this more administrative kind of compliancy thing and less about the human part of their...
I think they can be very human orientated, but it tends to be a very siloed view about what their role is. So it's easy to fall on a specialist expertise than it is to say, I'm really adding value to a company by understanding what that company is trying to do. The example of GM is a great one, right? They took somebody from engineering and put her into a turnaround role, and everybody laughed. They said, you know, you're in HR, your career's over. It's history. Mm-hmm. Goodbye. What happened? They turned the business around. She was like one of three women that was tipped to be the next CEO. But her point was that it's really about understanding how the business operates. She didn't need to be a functional expert to really add value. And so that's my kind of mantra to HR people today.
And then you're kind of a evangelist for more women in leadership roles. That's part of what you're bringing to the table as well.
Yeah, I do quite a lot of work with women leaders on their own and with corporations to trying to understand, you know, what is the issue that we face today, why inclusion and diversity is really important, and the value that it brings to companies that have more diversity, both from just a viewpoint perspective, but most importantly also from a performance perspective. So I do a lot of work around that, of dispelling some of the myths and language that we use that isn't always helpful.
So what are some of the myths?
the myth that if you are a working mother, that, you know, you, that means that you're likely to take time off because your kids may get sick, but it's okay for the father to go and play golf maybe with his colleagues, and that's acceptable, or go watch their kids play soccer. So there are some myths around that. There are myths around people's passion and desire to want to achieve more in their careers. I think there are myths around really understanding what talent capabilities are and way language gets used. So women that can be quite, I would say, confident, and can be perceived as aggressive, which is not always the case. And it's a two-way thing. I think, like, the conversation, to be honest, has to be a male-female conversation. This isn't a women's issue and it's not a male issue. It's a company issue that we need to address.
So now what kinds of companies do you primarily work with? These larger enterprise companies, mid-sized companies, small companies?
Right, across the board. Yeah. You know, having come, just moved to Atlanta in February and seeing some of the, like, the large international players that are here. I've worked with some of them in the past. But I also like to work with some startups because I think, as you saw and heard, the passion that people bring around their ideas is so important, and being able to sort of help them from a strategic perspective think about how do they build that capability and go to market is something that excites me.
Now, your organization is called DARE. Why is that called DARE?
It's like the name. It's kind of dare to be different, dare to see things differently, dare to try and be different, because in today's world, you absolutely, if you want to be successful, you've got to be bold. You've got to be willing to push the boundaries. You've got to be willing to trust your judgment and saying, like, I'm going to go for it. I don't necessarily know that I'm going to make it there in the first instance, but I have a view about where I want to go. And so we encourage people to, like, really confront that.
Now, how'd you get to Atlanta? What was the what compelled you to come here?
Yeah, my husband works for Amazon Web Services, and they asked him to relocate to Atlanta. I kind of travel a lot of the time. I'm like, it doesn't really matter where I'm based. Although I have to say, it's been a great experience being here.
So, what did you
far.
Think when you heard that that was a possibility going to Atlanta?
I was kind of excited. I've lived in lots of different places. I've traveled to lots of different countries with work. So I always find it really interesting because I view it as a learning opportunity for myself. I get to meet some new people, test my own thinking, broaden my own perspective.
So how did you, what was your vision of the South in America?
Well, I kind of knew a bit of the South because of previous work that I had done. But I confess, and I say this to people that I meet on a regular basis, the friendliness just overwhelms me. Having, you know, lived in DC before and London, when people really do come up to you and talk to you and want to help you, it's sort of a bit alien, and you're a bit like, why are they talking to me? Like, they want to help me. And I've been really blown away by that, to be honest, because it really is genuine.
So now, and you see that as different in other parts, places you've traveled?
Yeah.
It's this is what I find. I'm from South Florida. I was born in New York and raised in South Florida and came here maybe 30 years ago. And I find that to be true, that there's kind of a small town, large town thing here where you have that Southern hospitality. You have people that are open to conversations and collaborating. And it's not a zero sum game where they're trying to, like, use you to get to a higher place and walk all over you.
Yeah, no, I think that's really true based on the experience that I've seen so far.
So now now that you are here, are you going to immerse yourself in the community more, or you're just going to use this as kind of, I got the airport so I can go wherever I got to go?
No,
like, what's your brand strategy here in Atlanta?
So my brand strategy is really part of, like, my principles and ethics of how I work, which is if I'm in a place, I want to be able to give back to that place. So wherever I've been, I try to make some kind of commitment back into the community in which I live and work. So it is really important to me to find ways to sort of not just sort of build a business here, but find ways to contribute. So, you know, whether that's through women's organization, there's an organization called Pathmakers, Pathways for Women here that I've heard about, that I've tapped into and trying to understand, and just helping other businesses, really, just being a resource to say, bounce ideas off and help each other, because I think that's important.
So now you're from England, London?
I am from England, yeah. My parents were from India originally, but I was born in London, yes.
So now, do you have any opinions about all the
all the debacle that's going on in the UK? Yes, I've got lots of opinions on that.
Now, that's, you know, that seems like a game-changing things are happening now, that not in our lifetime that we've seen things like this that are happening.
Yeah, I think, and so today, as you know, yesterday, the results of the European elections have just finished and the results are coming out. Europe is quite surprised. Pleasantly, I say that the rise of sort of nationalism hasn't and populism hasn't reached the levels that they were concerned about. So that's good news from that perspective. But what we are seeing, and I think it is an interesting trend, is the empowerment of people to really take part in these kinds of elections and discussions today, whether that's the rise of social media or just more information. People are asking to have a say. We've seen that in the UK over Brexit. And we're also seeing, I think, what the impact of leadership is around these kinds of issues. So, you know, Theresa May, who's the UK Prime Minister, stepped down last week. Her career has not been a successful career as a leader. But what's interesting to me is her leadership failure comes from this desire to want to please everybody and not please anybody, a standoffishness that doesn't know how to relate and connect, an inability to build partnerships and look at compromise. And I think in today's world, whether it's business or politics, we need leadership that really has a very clear vision and a clear purpose, and that is able to navigate during these difficult times, because they are difficult, disruptive times today.
Now, do you think because of the fragmentation of the media and fragmentation of this ability for anybody to kind of have a say on social media, that you are getting such disparate kind of points of view and the ones that seem authentic, and whether, you know, they can build a tribe or an audience because they're have charisma or for whatever reason that people are resonating behind them, but it is splintering the group where it's hard to get a consensus and get everybody to collaborate and work to a common goal because nobody wants to kind of compromise. They say, I believe in this, and that's what's attracting a crowd is their belief and firm belief in something.
Yeah, and I think that's a difficult sort of balance to get, right?
Right.
Because there is so much news out there, and you know the sort of the cry about is this fake news or real news. It does require people to sort of really dig deep and look at that news,
right, and
say what is important and discern it. You know, and that's quite hard, right? Because
we're busy.
It's really difficult to figure that out, and I think that is a challenge. But I think it's also, you know, used appropriately and giving people enough information to be able to ascertain for themselves what's right for them, because it is about what's right for you. Like, nobody necessarily should make you believe something that you don't believe in.
Right.
What should drive you is what the things that you value. Everybody has different values and different opinions on those things. It's a challenge. I don't know the answer to the
you haven't
to
figured
that.
It out.
I haven't got that one. Yeah, I'm afraid.
But you've observed it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a challenging times now, and it's hard now for companies, especially, to navigate this.
Yeah, and you know, your comments on brand are really important, because a brand promise today, you know, years ago, it wasn't all over social media if a brand didn't deliver. You know, the Volkswagen scandal a few years ago wiped off $35 billion of their bottom line. Now, people that trusted this brand that was so trustworthy and reliable and honest, and it's blown away. So it is so important from that perspective, as you're working with clients, you must see every day of that importance.
So now, what do you need more of? How can we help you? You're here, you're new to town. We're all from here a little bit. From different degrees.
Yeah.
What can we do to help you?
I just love to meet fellow business people that are interested in talking about some of the stuff that they're doing. Businesses that may have a need around some sort of transformation or change, or really understanding their culture, get in touch, read my articles. I write a lot for newspapers, magazines. I do a couple of podcasts that can be quite engaging and maybe not, depending on what you like. Just get in touch, really. I'm eager to help the businesses work with clients, new industries, and maybe share some of the things that we've been doing, some of the unique tools that we bring, which we think are quite revolutionary. We'll see if they are or not, but we believe them to be, but that's what we'd like.
Now, when you're working with a company, is there a way that you typically enter the company? Like, what is the pain they're having, or what is that kind of low-hanging fruit that it lets you at least begin to have conversations with some of these firms?
Yeah, so the low-hanging fruit tends to be new leadership teams that are trying to come in, and so how do they sort of make their stance on the organization? Issues around productivity or innovation, so how do they now compete compete in a industry or market that is becoming crowded? Or talent, how do they identify talent within their organization and understand what culture they need to be able to cultivate that kind of culture? So those are kind of like the low-hanging fruits where we'll come in and we'll do some diagnostics and some talking. I often act as like a strategic advisor to a CEO, so not a coach, but somebody that's just an independent view that comes in and says, okay, let me open your eyes a little bit and give you that perspective that you may not always see. But those are the kinds of things.
And then you have a team or like you have a...
Yeah, so I work with a lot of independent consultants that are experts in their field that I've known for, over the years that are based across the US and the UK and other places. And through sort of partner with other organisations and consulting companies that are already working with an organisation where we're bringing something that adds value that they don't provide today but actually gives us... a greater opportunity together to give a client the kind of services that they're really looking for.
Now, has there been some transformation you're most proud of? Do you have a story you can share?
I've got lots of scars. Like,
you got scar tissue?
Yeah, yeah. I guess the biggest transformation that I think I ever did was when I worked for Honeywell for many years. It was my first job when I left university and I worked for Honeywell, who actually have a business unit here I see in Atlanta. They were based in Minneapolis at the time. And I left there to join a global utility company, energy company that was based in Virginia. They had 27,000 people and I was the third HR person that they had hired. They were, and my colleague, my friend over there is shaking his head going, yes, I know, I couldn't believe it either. But it was fascinating to come in to a company that had nothing, that had had a share price of about $100. It crashed. They'd gone to near bankruptcy. And my ex-boss said, hey, why don't you come in and help set up the talent development and leadership capabilities?
Morale was probably negative.
It was an interesting company. The morale wasn't necessarily because they had started to sort of
come back.
They got to like $7 a share, I think, when I joined. But what was interesting was they had been led by a CEO who was very passionate, who believed that you didn't need HR. Harvard Business School had written a book about them. It was called The Missing HR Department. I gladly now say, thank God they found it. the reality was that was a massive transformation because I had to come in. Nobody wanted HR. Nobody liked HR. We were like the bad people and really build something of value. And take that organization through five transformations in 6 years, including a CEO transformation. We ended up with a team of HR people that were wanted, that were asked for, not pushed to the organization. So that was pretty cool. Put in place their first leadership development program, working with a university in the area that went global. So they went and taught in their international businesses. So, yeah, that was probably a lot of hard work. A lot of disbelief of people saying that you're going to be able to make this happen. But it happened because we had like a lot of people that wanted to do something and make a difference.
And that's at the core of everything, right?
Yeah.
Somebody has to want to make a difference.
Yeah.
Well, good stuff, Will Reed. Thank you so much for making a difference.
Thank you very much for inviting me here.
All right. So if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the coordinates for your organization?
The website is www.dareworldwide.com. You can find me on Twitter at Rita_Trahan. And on LinkedIn, I'm at www.linkedin.com/in/Rita Trahan.
All right. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Sanjay Ture and all our guests here today. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.